Dear Dan, even your former students probably wouldn't call you Mr. Wood after 25 years, and yet this familiar salutation seems unnatural for me. Even though you didn't know me by this name I've employed, I think you'll figure out who I am, a student teacher you supervised in the late 70s. Much as I'd like to, it will be difficult to begin this letter with the ordinary "how are you, I am fine" hollow gesture. Decades have gone by since you last saw me, and I have no way of knowing if you even remember. And then there's the issue of writing a letter, which nobody does anymore. No Google search has brought me anywhere near an email address for you, but in the archived news items about you, I've found your attorney's name and was then able to locate his business address. It is up to him whether or not this letter will find you, but he has my permission to read it first. I'll say up front, for your attorney's information as well as yours, that while I would eagerly provide any kind of testimony, from character witness to eyewitness, I am intelligent enough to know that my services in those areas would be anywhere from worthless to downright detrimental. What kind of character witness would have only known the defendant for 4 months, well over 20 years ago? And as eyewitness, I didn't see much. Once I was alone in the office with a girl who was crying. The rest of the time, all of the girls, and I assume she was one of them, preened and flaunted themselves without inhibition. Many looked at me with inhospitality and resentment, the way members of a wolf pack eye an interloper. The other things I observed, from the magazines in your briefcase to the 5-minute movies they showed for 50 cents in the booths at the back of the adult bookstore in Oceanside where you took me, would, I realize, not portray you in a useful or comprehensive way. Yes, I only knew you for less than a year. Our period of daily contact was just about 4 months. Yet, while there are people I knew during the same time who I barely or don't remember, those 4 months at Mount Marcos High School have remained a significant marker in my personal resume. Looking through my spring 1979 journal, amid the rantings and deliberations that don't have enough context for me to now comprehend what I was talking about, I've found anguished exclamations about wasting a year of my life. What am I going to do? I can't do this. This is killing me. I was a horrible teacher for more reasons than just that it wasn't one of my capabilities. Although 23, my brain was still unfinished and simply could not concentrate on any task outside my needs and angst. If assigned to an accomplished model teacher robot as apprentice, the same conclusions would have been determined. This was not something this girl could or should do. But I was given to someone who was more than a teacher with a capital T. I was assigned to a more complete person by virtue of his human flaws, with enough empathy to not only see more in my difficulties than just an untalented teacher, but to address me on that other, deeper, and more bothersome level. And of course, this is why I've bookmarked that time and you, probably mythologizing both, hopefully in a meaningful way. Given the fact that everyone is the center of only their own universe, a brief intersection of two lives is often far more significant for one than it is for the other. Thus, as other major events in your life came along, you may not or may only vaguely remember me. And on my end, in my never-comfortable mind, I thought I'd already fully explored, many times over, my recollections of you. But recently, I have begun the memory excavations all over again. I was deeply dismayed, just a few weeks ago, to hear from a friend, a former vague acquaintance of yours, of the circumstances pertaining to your departure from Mount Marcos High School. The report given me, however, was not only unspecific but incorrect. I was told you'd been convicted. A simple internet search provided me a fuller picture. The charges appropriately dropped, followed by the predictable, self-pitying lawsuit brought about by the victim. My response is apt to make me sound a hypocrite to the feminist liberal views I value, but that's where people are wrong about both feminists and liberals. A true feminist knows that women can have significant weaknesses and can easily cause or exacerbate their own problems, and that men likewise feel things, fear things, and might make poor choices influenced by or based on their confusion or emotional needs or even misconstructed best intentions. I do feel my visceral first response to learning the more complete published details of your situation is somewhat significant, though, because I quickly realized my 4 months of student teaching with you in 1979 lie in the middle of your relationship with the girl. So yes, this recognition sent me back to excavate my memory and my journals, and even those student teaching notes you kept for me during your observations. What I'm looking for, I'm not sure. I had already been very aware on a few different levels of your marital difficulties at the time. In fact, this was the field on which we connected in ways beyond mentor and student. And the fact that you are experiencing your own torment has made your willingness to address mine far more significant to me. I've realized it still more in the years afterward, and in fact, your attention then means more now that I am aware of the complicated situation you were struggling with. On April 26, 1979, my journal records this short dialogue. Me, when does life begin? Maybe 23? You, maybe 31? Part of my mind has us frozen there, at 23 and 31, neither of us knowing the full extent of our own despair, and yet tacitly sharing it with each other. Most of my response to learning about the charges against you has been from a selfish attempt to remember who I was at the time. At 23, I felt intimidated by the way the 16-year-olds at that school seemed so comfortable in their obvious and often flaunted sexuality. I felt unequal to it. I felt inferior to it. I felt retarded compared to it. My perspective then would have never conceived that these were girls or women who did not know what they were doing. And nothing I've seen of the average middle-class, heady 16-year-old girl since then has changed my mind. I've recently seen other 16-year-olds, however, and 14-year-olds, and maybe even younger girls, not only on the fringes of society, but on the outskirts of civilization, in the scrub and bushes of uncultivated canyons, who are compelled to spread their legs not for one man, but for 30 or 40 men a day, 6 men an hour, on the bare ground, with dry grass and tumbleweeds for walls. The men themselves are treated no better than livestock, rounded up, cued into lines. With cattle, though, there is one bull, prized and pampered, who services every cow. In these fields, she accepts dozens of bulls, and tomorrow dozens more. This goes on mere miles from where we live in stucco houses, prune flowers in our pretty yards, shop for groceries and eat ice cream and rent movies, drive to work or school in SUVs or convertibles. They can be chased and scattered into the canyons and ravines, but it will still be going on again tomorrow in another place. Dead girls can be replaced. So, 25 years ago, one 16-year-old thinks she's extraordinary because she has attracted a 30-year-old man and consents to be his lover, proving her ultimate value to herself. And 25 years later, when she cries foul, the newspapers, the lawyers, the prosecutors, the talk show mavens zero in on her beguiled lover as a piece of vermin who sickens moral society. Meanwhile, abducted teenagers, 14, 15, maybe as young as 11 or 12, are being fucked 30, 40, 50 times a day by that many men in rooms made of flattened chaparral. And where are the voices raised in protest, the hoisted fists of moral outrage, the saturation of media interest? Where? I don't know if I'm finished, but I'll pretend I am, in case I am, in case I mail this tomorrow. Regards, Hester Smith.